Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this Word in Your Ear is brought to you by NordVPN. And once again, VPN, Mark, stands for...
It stands for Virtual Private Network.
You speak it like a native
now. I do. I know. Good.
And you could probably even explain that it's a way to keep your data safe on the internet, particularly whenever you're logging in, either from home or at home or abroad, in an unusual place like an internet cafe or not in your normal setup. A VPN protects your identity and encrypts your data, so that nobody can steal your identity. So those are the very sound, sober reasons why NordVPN is a good idea. But they're also fun reasons. It enables you to access the internet via servers in many, many different countries. So you can get up in the morning and decide, where do I want to be today? Do I want to be in Sweden and South Korea, in the United States, in wherever? And this means you can often sidestep the traditional region restrictions, which means you can only watch certain movies and certain TV programs in certain countries. So you can probably get around that in many cases and have lots of interesting listening and viewing experiences that you wouldn't be able to do if you were just tethered purely to the UK. And so I've been increasing...
What have you been watching?
I've been in all sorts of things. I tell you what, it struck me. I tell you what struck me recently. So many kind of crime dramas, aren't they? On stream crime dramas.
Yeah.
There are just a million and one of them nowadays. And what I've discovered about them, the thing they all have in common, is they all start really strongly, because that's where they spend all the money, is in the first two or three episodes, you know, because that's when you get all the spectacle. That's when you get all the whiz bangs. And then when it gets towards later in the series, they don't really know. Here's the problem. They can't finish them as well as they start them.
That seems to me the case. Because they don't know that they're going to get another series.
Well, that's
Breaking Bad's a really good case, I think, because Breaking Bad, five series, and at the end of virtually every one, there's this kind of lurching cliffhanger where they don't know if they've got the funding to come back, but they have to leave some proposition open to be resolved. But Breaking Bad does end fantastically.
Oh, well, that's good.
You get to the end.
I've never seen Breaking Bad, so that's a good thing. If it finishes,
Walter rigs up the machine gun.
I mean, don't tell. Don't spoil it for me or for anybody else, and who might be watching this. And so I shall, you know, redouble my efforts to get around to seeing it. But most of the things, even the good things, Sopranos and whatever, there is no ending, really. Yeah. You know, they don't lend themselves to an ending at all. And I tell you what, the other thing I've found is the crime drama. If you get when you start watching it and you get hooked on it, and after a while you think, how many episodes is this? And so you then look, and you think, all right, there's 10. okay, at what point are they going to reveal who did it? It's going to be in episode 9, isn't it? You know what I mean? And then number 10 is going to be tying up the loose ends, you know? So it's a slightly unsatisfactory viewing experience, I find, that kind of thing. But listen, if people have got recommendations of other things that finish as strongly as they start, we'd love to hear about them. Anyway, it's early days, but you can take advantage of a deal where you can try NordVPN by going to nordvpn.com/, here's the important thing, /your ear, or just use the code your ear to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan. And also one additional month for free and a bonus gift. And it's no risk because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. And further details are in the show notes underneath this.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, Mark, let's start with a quiz that I've pinched out of BuzzFeed, which I thought you'd like. What you have to do, I'm going to read you some
lyrics. My lamentable performances at quizzes are going to be shown up in sharp relief once again. Go on, give me a go.
This is so defensive. okay. The idea of the quiz is, are these lyrics Bruce Springsteen or are they Taylor Swift? Okay.
Oh, that's good.
Bruce Springsteen or Taylor Swift.
It's the return of Stackwardy.
Here we go. It's the first one. There's a crazy mirror showing us both in 5D. I'm laughing at you. You're laughing at me. Is that Taylor Swift?
It's
or
obviously got to be Taylor Swift because Springsteen would never use the expression 5D.
Well, you'd be wrong because okay. It's from the Bruce Springsteen song, Tunnel of Love. Okay. Second one, you were in college working part-time, waiting tables, left a small town, never looked back. Is that Bruce Springsteen or is it Taylor Swift?
Well, that could be either, couldn't it? That's very plausible each way. I'm saying Springsteen.
You'd be wrong because it's Taylor Swift.
Okay. It's like a penalty shooter, two misses.
Yes, I'll just throw you one more. I hold you on my arms as the band plays. What are those words whispered, baby, just as you turn away? Is that Taylor Swift or is it Bruce Springsteen?
Springsteen.
Yes, it is. It's Bruce Springsteen. It's from Brilliant Disguise. Okay, well, the rest
of it's there. That's good.
The rest of it's there. So anyway, I have in my hand, and I'm tempted to recharge it, my old iPod. Because the iPod, I hear, is being finally knocked on the head. Is that
right?
It is
no longer being manufactured. The end of an era. I tried to find mine. I've got two and I couldn't find them. I've got all my mobile phones. God knows why I kept them. They're extraordinary. But so you found it and does it still work?
I found it and I'm currently attempting to charge it. I was amazed it responded at all. This is a 40 gigabyte one. So I think it's probably quite a late one. And I've still got it connected because I daren't disconnect it because I think it'll lose its charge. But, you know, if I go into the music there, it's got playlists. And because it's intriguing, you know, what the playlists I had there that I made. Oh, Louis Armstrong playlist. I've got a Decembrists, playlist. The Hazards of Love, is that Decembrists album?
Yeah, it is.
I've got a thing called Frontin', which is a big kind of hip-hop thing. I don't even know when was the day when this all happened. And so the amazing thing about the iPod is it was so revolutionary and so short-lived, wasn't it?
It was. Now, the key thing was not only could you have all those songs on a little tiny object in your pocket, but the shuffle mode. Didn't you think that was amazing? In fact, there was the thing called the iPod Shuffle. So I got it was like a little, like about the size of a stick.
Yeah, I've still got one of those. Yeah,
and I think you could get 220 songs on it. And it was very thrilling. You'd set out walking to the tube thinking, I don't know what song I'm going to get out of these 220, but I do know that I have I will like it.
I'm a liker.
I chose it. You know what I mean? I just don't know what order it's coming in. That was really exciting. But yeah, it was very short-lived, wasn't it? Incidentally, you bought me you were going to America on some trip for Word, I think, And you bought an iPod for me because it was so much cheaper in America. And when you handed over to me and I handed you the Dosh, it arrived with 1,500 tracks that you put on it. I think it was 1,500.
Well, they might have
downloaded it. And it was fantastic. And this is how I really discovered my enthusiasm for Bob Skaggs and Freddie King as well. I got various other people that I just really got into. It was brilliant. Entirely because of you. Good work. So,
do you remember before the iPod, the kind of early MP3 players? Did you ever... Yeah. Did one of those ever find its way into your hands? I had one, and I thought it was an absolute miracle because you could load as many as 20 songs onto it.
I know, but yeah,
20 songs.
It was the volume is the kind of the volume of stuff is the kind of key issue in all this, isn't it? Do you remember there used to be a thing? Oh, it probably still is. A principle that used to refer to as Moore's Law. Do you know Moore's Law?
No, I don't remember that.
And they used to say, dealing with, forgive me, I'm getting completely beyond my competence here, but I'm sure there's many people listening and know far more about this than I will do. But roughly, what it meant is that the amount of memory available increases or it doubles at a certain rate really quickly at the same time as the price of it goes down. And so that's what's happened in the last 20 years.
It's
Moore's laws of what's happened in the last 20 years. So, you know, what was a miracle, you know, 20 years ago, which was 20 songs on one player.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a miracle any longer because it's 20 million probably.
Yeah.
Or 20,000 certainly, you know. And as we have more and more access to more and more, our relationship with it has to change, surely, you know, because it's not rare anymore, is it? And so people became, the thing about the iPod is it surely massively reduced people's patience with music.
Completely. It had to.
Because you listen to music the way you increasingly watch everything and read everything, which is what your thumb hovering over the button.
Completely. And the moment you think you're bored, zap through it, or you can just go on to the next one. I find that as terrible whenever you find something on YouTube and you think, I just want to get to the part of the song that I like the most, which is an appallingly disrespectful thing to do.
Well, exactly. That's increasingly how records are made. They're made in that in exactly the same way.
Knowing they have to engage your attention absolutely.
Completely.
Ram stuff in there.
But it's just extraordinary, you know. They were such a revolution, weren't they? And yet now we're digging them out of dusty old drawers and trying to get them working.
Yeah,
it's absolutely extraordinary.
Do you think there'll be a market in? I mean, I don't know because we were talking about this the other day. There's no moving parts. It's not like there's something about a cassette where you can kind of see it whirring round and it seems to be a piece of machinery. Whereas that, I don't know. Do you think
it's worth
money
think
in
so.
10 years' time?
Well, it probably might be, I suppose, but there's no great delight in looking at the thing or listening to the way the wheel clicks as you go around and choose your favourites. I can't really see it, you know, but... Because that's the other thing. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, that it's like the difference between traditional media and digital media is that, you know, when you tape something, when an album was recorded on tape, they could look at it and there it is on the tape and they could put it on the player and they could hear it. As soon as it's recorded on loads and loads of different forms of hard drives, you're at the mercy of the retrieval systems that are used for you to find your way around it. And these things change, you know what I mean? And so going and trying to get an old version of Windows working or something is probably a lot harder than going into a drawer digging out the paper, you know, that was once the records that were subsequently digitized. So it's not going to be... It's not going to be straightforward in the future, you know. You know, whether these things will continue to have any use in our lives.
But so I remember when it was invented, I remember the Word magazine running a series of pieces about this has totally changed our relationship with music, which it had, actually.
It was on the cover of Word, wasn't it?
It was.
Because it was the biggest story.
There's a picture of B.B. King, I think, with
Well, no, that iPod. Was a later one. No, we had a cover. There was a cover of Word that was just, it was a blue cover with a load of iPods.
That's right, it was.
And that was earlier.
And there was the great scandal where you felt that it destroyed the idea of context, that you didn't anymore look at the idea that music was created in a certain year, a certain time, by a certain... Everything was out of sequence. You didn't realise in what order things came, what influenced what, you know.
I'll tell you, parallel to that, and I was thinking about this week, I read another piece about it's the end of magazines, you know. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember what triggered this particular piece, and I wouldn't wildly disagree with that point. Although there are still odd little pockets where, titles continue to do very well. Private Eye and Spectator and whatever, but boy, they're a tiny minority.
Well, Anna Wintour's memoir was what reminded me of that, because there she is writing about the glory days of being in the office, but kind of in the office as regards magazines is not necessarily the thing anymore, is it? And that was the heart and soul of it.
Oh God, yeah.
It was just people being in an office and just riffing off each other and just kind of coming up with a whole new language and writing headlines together.
It was also the noise.
Yeah.
You know, because you and I are old enough to remember working in magazine offices where they used to have things called typewriters. And typewriters made a row all the time.
Sound.
And you could tell whether somebody was working or not because you could hear them working.
Yeah. If they weren't typing, they were looking out the window.
They weren't sending an email to somebody. And the other thing is that every transaction had to be conducted on the telephone.
Yeah.
And so if it was conducted on the telephone, everybody in the office would hear it.
Could hear.
Or hear one side of it. So phone calls became a huge performance, didn't they?
Yeah, you were playing to a gallery.
And I can remember slightly before this, my first experience of any kind of music business environment was somebody said to me, oh, you can go and spend the day in the Island Records sales office. This would be about 1974 or something like this. And so I went down to Island Records when they were in St. Peter's Square in Hammersmith. And they were all crowded in there, and there was a little recording studio out the back that Steve Lillywhite ran, and, you know, there would be Bob Marley in reception, you know, all that kind of thing. And the sales office was down in the basement, and it was a round table. And I think there were five or six people around this table who just spent the entire livelong day
on the telephone. Yeah.
Just
talking bollocks.
Selling, you know, and bantering and, you know. And the energy of these people was just absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is so exciting. And, of course, you went to the same office nowadays. Well, for a start, it wouldn't be Island. It would be Universal.
And it'd be completely silent. Just be people emailing.
Tappity-tappity-tappity.
And
actually, it wouldn't even be people. It'd just be machines. It would just be machines communicating with other machines, because nobody... Well, there isn't a kind of W.H. Smith's in, you know, Welling Garden City's ring anymore. But, you know, even if there were, you know, the stock would be replenished magically by barcodes and, you know, orders placed automatically, you know, all that kind of thing. There's no human interaction.
No. But I remember it as being a kind of communal fight. You know, I remember it smash hits. You know, I'd be on the phone trying to get the Duran Duran cover story. And our ad man, the great Rod Sopp, would be on the phone at the other side of the desk, sort of going, your lucky day. A little bit of a space has opened up.
It's your lucky day.
A little bit of a space has opened up. You might be able to fill it at a discount at a mate's rate. You know? So brilliant.
But the other thing about magazines that struck me recently, I've been working on a book, you know, which is you know, it's over a period of 50, 60, 70 years. And when you're dealing in stuff that happened in the 50s and 60s and 70s or whatever, you're looking at published sources. And therefore, you're reading context at the same time as you're reading content.
Yeah.
As soon as you're looking at anything in the 21st century, that's gone. Utterly gone. When did something happen? Did 2010 feel any different from 2008? Well, it's very difficult to tell whether it did or it didn't.
But if you're looking at a magazine, there's all the ads, there's all the, you know, the news stories.
Same with the news
faces.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas everything just
photography
just floats free of its moorings, you know, once it's in digital space, you know. And I do think it's going to be very hard in the future. Well, yeah, feel sorry for the historians of the future attempting to, to describe what happened in the 21st century, because all the information will be there, but none of the shape of it. You know, it'd be very difficult to get an idea of the shape of it. So,
you just open up any copy of a magazine, and it will completely reboot that moment in time perfectly.
Talking to magazines, did you see the story about
Vogue? this is a great story.
It's a great story.
This is a story. Now, if I remember right, this is a guy, there's a pub in Cornwall called the Star Inn at Vogue.
Yes.
Because Vogue is a little village.
Because Vogue is one of many things I didn't know until reading the story. Vogue is an old Cornish word. That's what he claims.
It's not an English word. It's a Cornish word. But that's the name of the pub. It's been there for 200 years. It's called the Star Inn at Vogue. And somebody working for the publishers of Vogue, Condé Nast, discovered this and immediately, very hastily assumed that they had appropriated the brand. Am I right? Is this cease and desist.
I don't think a human being will ever have had any part in this at all. I think this will just be that Condé Nast will have a machine set up. The word, if the word Vogue appears at company's house, which is how this happened, it triggers it's machine sends off a cease and desist letter. How dare you appropriate our trademark?
Yeah.
You know? And but this guy's letter.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant.
Back to them.
He says, I noted your letter. He says, you've only been in existence since 1916. He's talking to them. He's talking to Vogue magazine. And I presume that at that time, when you chose the name Vogue in the capitalized version, you didn't seek permission for the villagers of the real Vogue. he's turning the tables and saying, you should have asked us for permission. I also presume that Madonna did not seek your permission to use the word Vogue, again, the capitalized version, for her 1990s song of the same name. It's just a brilliant idea that he's saying, you owe me money.
Yeah, bloody right. Absolutely.
They must feel ridiculous. But didn't he actually get a physical letter? Did he not get a physical letter?
Oh, he probably did get a physical letter, but they're all
on must have signed that. But God,
okay, maybe.
They look ridiculous.
They do.
Such a good story.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Well, I don't know about you, but there's that combination of kind of excitement and terror that I find, I'm the same with my oldest son too, about the news that Spinal Tap are going to make a sequel after 40 years. I mean, I felt that about Ghostbusters and about Anchorman, both films I liked very much, actually. Anchorman particularly, I thought it was fantastic. You think, Anchorman 2, how exciting and how terrible it was. How absolutely rotten. So will this, I mean, who knows? I mean, there they are. It came out in 1984. In 2024, they are going to release they're going to release Spinal Tap 2. And how old are they now?
They're in the 70s, surely.
Harry Shearer is 79, I think. I think Christopher Guest and Michael McKean are 74.
There you go.
And the concept is, if I remember rightly, and it's quite a good concept, actually, and uses the idea that Christopher Guest used in all his films, like Guffman and Best in Show and Mighty Wind, which is that the drama builds towards a performance. So that the idea is, that's the structure of it. The idea is that Ian Faith, the manager, who's died in the film,
who actually
died in real life,
and the actor,
Tony Hendrick, his wife has a contract which says that Spinal Tap were contracted to play one more show, and she will sue them if they don't. So the three members have to reunite and perform the show. And I mean, I think there's rich comedy potential actually for what they've been doing in the last 40 years, and also for writing material that's kind of middle-aged lyrics, because they were sort of middle-aged anyway, Spinal Tap, weren't they? You felt they were just too old. Do you remember the bit where one of them's back goes when he's on stage?
I do think this is the kind of interesting thing, is that the great joke of Spinal Tap is, when talking in the original film, once you've seen it, the idea of it just lodges in your mind.
Yeah.
And it never goes away. And it just becomes a wonderful metaphor for all kinds of things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so you see these pictures of these men who have clearly middle-aged faces. You know, they look as if they ought to be over the garden wall discussing lawnmowers or traffic calming issues or whatever. But instead, they've got these ridiculous wigs. And they're wearing leopard skin.
Yeah, they're wearing spandex.
All that kind of stuff. And it's the contrast between the kind of the
middle-aged faces and old faces. Yeah,
absolutely. Does that get funnier when they're in the 70s? I don't know. You know, it'll be the idea of dealing with the passage of time. That will be the biggest challenge
in making
the film work, you know. And you know, and I think also you mustn't forget is part of the reason they're doing this is that they get huge credit for it, you know, for Spinal Tap. Every time any of them goes on any TV show or radio show or whatever, somebody eventually wants to talk about Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of them ever made any money out of it. Because of the way it was done, you know, it was so completely a low budget. They didn't even have a script, I'm thinking, right?
No, they didn't. No, no.
They said, just give us some money. We'll just go off and make this film.
I interviewed them, but they had a little structure, which is they knew what the in was for each take. They knew what the part of the plot they had to allude to was. And they knew what the out was. And the rest in between, they could just improvise. It was absolutely astonishing. But do you think they made no money?
Yeah, I bet they didn't make anything. Oh, no,
maybe that's something. Why they formed the band and toured, because the band did the band played festivals. Band played,
I know, but they'd have done that for kicks, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I can't believe any of them walked away from it with a significant amount of money. Whereas if you're going to come along however many years later, 40 years later, with a new one, you'll get a 2022 deal, won't you?
Yeah.
Right. For streaming or something, you know, it could be quite a big deal for somebody.
And you've got to admit that the audience for it will be massive.
Well, it won't be massive.
I think it would be pretty
good. No, Mark, it won't be.
I mean, I'm not talking massive, Top Gun massive.
It's not Lord of the Rings.
No, but it'll still be very substantial.
Well, it'll be there. It'll be there, yeah, undoubtedly. And best of luck to them, you know, because they're all still here, aren't they?
They're all still
well,
going.
Apart from Tony Hendra and Rob Reiner and so forth, and they're still terribly funny and terribly talented people. You know, best of luck to them in doing it. Now, talking of things that took place in the past, is it 50 years ago this week?
Exile.
Since the release of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
I hold in my hand my copy of Exile on Main Street that I bought 50 years ago.
There it is. We've got the CD here.
Oh, right. Okay. And I remember it coming out. And here's the interesting thing about Exile on Main Street. I always felt it got really kind of lukewarm reviews, because it didn't seem to really have any songs on it. And it's interesting, looking back at the story of the Rolling Stones making it, and they recorded it mostly in 1971 in Nelcott, in the basement. And the complaint all the way through it was, why the hell don't you write some songs? You know, Ian Stewart said, why don't you write some songs? Stop doing, you know.
They're kind of riffs, aren't they, really?
They're riffs.
Yeah.
And I think it was only knocked into shape when they took it to Los Angeles and you know, and did the mix and put the you know, the female singers on it there and all that kind of stuff.
But God, it has some moments, though. Rip This Joint. Isn't that wonderful?
I still think the greatest moment of Exile and Ministry is still the opening of Tumbling Dice.
Yeah.
Which is that slurred guitar sound that nobody else can do. And they couldn't do it any longer after they'd done it once, you know. That's a remarkable
Is it the last sound. Great Stones record?
Well, is it one that the people, it always intrigues me, is whenever people want to praise the Rolling Stones record ever since, they've always said, it's their best since Exile on Main Street. They always say that. And, you know, with varying degrees of justification. I'll tell you what I think it is. I don't think it's the best Rolling Stones album, but I think it's the most fashionable Rolling Stones album. It's the most voguish Rolling Stones album. It's for the people who like Rolling Stones Mark II, i.e. not the itchy little pop group of the 60s. They like the kind of whole mythology.
Well, that's right.
And all that sort of stuff. And Exile on Main Street does that brilliantly well. And do you know one of the reasons it does it? And I'm going to get out my copy here and just pull out the inner bags. It's because of these pictures.
Your pictures are fantastic, aren't they?
The pictures of them with green light.
But I think that's the image of the Stones that still presides. Because there's sort of three versions. There's the very early modish, kind of modish, kind of thin ties, button-down shirts, kind of mid-60s Stones. There's the kind of psychedelic adventurers, which I think was very unconincing, particularly Bill and Charlie, who never looked right in kind of satin raiment. I have to wear this? Yeah. And then there's the Exile on Main Street. There was that kind of sluttish, slovenly kind of
but wealthy. That was the key thing was also about Nellcott, and it's really funny we should say this about Nellcott, because somebody this week sent us a book about Nellcott.
A fantastic book.
A Norwegian guy
called Geir Horns.
Yes.
Amazing
it's
book.
Just an extraordinary piece of work. We'll try and publish a link to it. You'll find out about it. Because it's the history of the whole house. It obviously includes the Rolling Stones period there, but it has a rich and extraordinary history. But the point about Nellcott is that's fixed in our mind, isn't it? That these kind of urchins were living in wealth and splendor. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's a combination of, we don't care, we might as well be in a squat, but oh, look, we're in a fabulous house on the French Riviera. That's right. You know.
And yet we've kind of, you know, I haven't had a shower for weeks and we've got bare feet.
Yes.
You can almost, there's something fragrant about those pictures. There's something that just kind of, the scent of unwashed bodies, I think, you know. It's so 70s, isn't it? But that's the image of the Stones that still prevails. That's how you see them, really. I mean, I think Black and Blue is a good record. You know, Black and Blue came out for years. I mean, it's got Hot Stuff and Hand of Fate and Cherry O' Baby and Hey Negrita and, you know, Fool to Cry. I think, I mean, it's a good record, but possibly in some ways a better record. But Exile on Main Street is what we have in our heads, isn't it? It's what governs our view of what the Stones have become.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I was just watching an interview with the Black Keys on Joe Rogan, and they've got a new record out. And they're talking about many years ago, he said, well, when we were destitute, I think they were when they were first making records, but you know, they hadn't broken through. He said, we were destitute. We probably had, you know, $200 in the bank. That's all we had. And we got an offer for one of our tracks to be used in a commercial. And our manager at the time said to us, if you do this, if you accept this money, this will be the end for you. You'll never have any credibility. You can wave goodbye to having any kind of career. And so they said, oh, all right. They didn't take it. Well, they haven't regretted it because they've had a fantastic career, a very successful group. But, you know, but they say they're looking back on it. It says, does anybody care? You know, and I think it's perfectly fair.
It's a
point.
Really, really good point, because people used to be so, I mean, the Stones did a Rice Krispies advert
Oh,
not that many people found out.
Oh, that's very early on, yes.
So he did a kind of ice cream over, I think. And people did do things. And John Lydon famously did that butter advert, which I think he got away with, actually. But, I mean, you know, everyone was terribly critical about it, weren't they? But now I think they appreciate it. Musicians have to make money.
Of course
they do. Jingles, and they're selling stuff to, I don't know, soundtracks, and they're, you know, there's any possibility they can make some cash in a world where nobody pays for music anymore is totally legitimate. And you can sympathise, can't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Feist and the Ting Tings are two really good examples of groups who were doing, I don't think they were doing all right, but, you know, it was the Apple ads that absolutely made their careers. The fact that they used their songs on ads for, I think, for iPods, actually, that made them, really.
Yeah, yeah. And so Bob Dylan also, you know, is generally regarded as the person who's above all this kind of thing. He quite happily Victoria's Secret.
Hello.
Oh, dear.
What's so funny about Victoria's Secret is if you're going to do an ad, then to do Victoria's Secret is probably the most kind of opposite to your brand values.
Absolutely.
It's kind of offensive, actually, to a lot of people that you could possibly imagine. But he just thought, I'll do it, you know.
Yes, it's just
so funny.
He just likes the idea of being associated with scantily clad young women.
Yeah, yeah.
That's basically it. Yeah. Yeah, that's Bob. He takes the perverse route in every situation.
Me on his last broadcast, the one he did during lockdown, you know, which was shot in a little kind of, supposedly in a kind of bordello in LA, wasn't it? And the audience were just fabulous looking girls wearing very little and kind of dancing and actors dressed up as kind of 1920s hoods. No, God bless him. And also his archive's just opened, isn't it?
His archive has opened. Where is it opened?
Tulsa.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa.
Yeah.
It's a very Bob Dylan place, isn't it? Tulsa.
Yeah, Tulsa.
That's kind of the middle of nowhere, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah,
I've never been to Tulsa. What's happened? He's thrown all his possessions towards somebody to organise them into an archive.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, he's kept everything, which is, you know, which so many people must be so regretful that they haven't, but he's somehow just squirreled away, like Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney's a massive warehouse, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You've been round and seen the kind of sort of Sergeant Pepper suit that he's still got, you know. But, you know, there are 6,000 items. And it's interesting, really, because, you know, I had a look at it this morning and they talks about, you know, the essays, poems, liner notes, correspondence. There's a fantastic handwritten manuscript version, early version of Chimes of Freedom, written on, have you seen it, on a kind of Waldorf Astoria hotel.
Oh, really?
With cigarette burns and stains. I mean, it's just exactly the crossings out and the adjustments to the lyric. Those kind of things are fantastic. But I'm not sure, really, you know, kind of essays and philosophical musings, do they work in museums? I don't know what you want to see in a museum.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like the idea that you can listen to unreleased tracks and things. That doesn't seem to be why I would want to go to a museum. I wouldn't mind doing that at home, clicking on something on my computer. But what you really want to see is objects. And in Dylan's case, I don't know what those objects would be. I mean, whether they're guitars, obviously, I think stage clothes are really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if I thought I could go and see the original Sergeant Pepper suits, I would be quite excited by that, actually. I don't know why, because they're physical things that they're there in a glass.
And what's the first thing that would strike you whenever you're looking at the costume of a famous rock star? What's the first?
It's smaller than you imagine.
Tiny. It's tiny.
Like seeing Henry VIII's suit of armor, which is about 4 foot high and 4 foot wide, actually.
They were all tiny, you know, and they were young and they were thin.
Yeah.
At the time that they wore them, I was reading this piece by in the New York Times about the Dylan archive and there's an interview with Sean Willance, who's a guy we've actually had on the podcast many, many years ago. An American academic has written extensively about American history and about Bob Dylan. A really good book called Dylan in America, I think it is. And he says, they say, do you think Dylan will be interested in this? He said, no, I don't think he will be. But I don't care that he isn't. It's sort of not to do with him anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought it's a really fair point, this is, you know, that you know, you don't control people's interest in this sort of stuff. You know, you've kind of got a responsibility to make it available. But again, you know, going back to our earlier discussion, the reason McCartney and Bob Dylan have got all this stuff is they did most of their stuff in the days of print and paper.
Yeah, so there is something
pen and ink. There's something to have.
You know. What are people doing? Keeping records of text messages? I mean, I don't know. But also, in both their cases, it wouldn't necessarily have been them. Some astute person like Neil Aspinall in McCartney's case would have thought, let's just collect everything we possibly can because it's going to have some kind of value.
Yeah.
And right, they were.
Yeah. So we're coming up to Paul McCartney's 80th birthday on June the 18th. And if you haven't already done so, make sure you get your tickets to come along to Word in the Park at Opera Hall and Park on that day, Saturday afternoon, when we'll be there with Danny Baker, with Julia Rayside, with Andy Miller and with Jeff Lloyd and with more to come.
And with one more very significant guest to
announce. Yeah, and so make sure you get your tickets. A splendid time is guaranteed for all. The sun is going to shine. There will be fruity drinks. There will be old friends. You'll kick yourself if you miss it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.